Anyone joining our discussion now, it's the last 10 minutes of the environmental law class for November 14, 2016. If you'd like to know the exciting things that happened before this, you need to talk with Art. I'll try and get it from you and put it up there. Okay. In addition to simply listing the species itself, the secretary must also identify the critical habitat that that species needs to thrive. By statute, the secretary can only look at the best available scientific data for the actual listing determination. Here, and now this gets to your question, in determining critical habitat, he can look at best available scientific and commercial data and consider the economic impact of determining the habitat. To give an example, if I have a determination that I need to make that polar bears are endangered or threatened, I have to just look at the data regarding the integrity of the species itself for the list determination of the species. Determining how much of the Arctic wilderness is preserved for them, I can include the cost impact of how many millions of acres I'm going to put in there. Does that make sense, everyone? These two, as a result, do have a tension built into them. And what you'll end up with is a lot of fighting, not only here, but also on the extent of the critical habitat, because this is a land use question. This is a species question. So we'll talk about Section 9 of the Clean Endangered Species Act says, I cannot harm, harass, or injure an endangered or threatened species. But for critical habitat purposes, the secretary can actually determine what's called with a special rule that a threatened species is not going to have a full critical habitat designated for it. So being threatened or endangered has a big impact on the power of the statute to protect it. So to give a bit of flavor what we're talking about, real quickly. And this is what we just talked about. Essentially, the listing is the first part we're talking about, Section 4. We'll talk about quickly Section 7 on the consultation requirement as class is wrapping up. But here's the definition of species itself. Any subspecies of fish or wildlife or plants in any distinct population segment is the key word there, of any species of vertebrate fish or wildlife which interbreeds when mature. Does that sort of comply with your intuitive sense? A species is a species, is a type of animal that resembles itself and can interbreed in such a way that it can't interbreed with other species. Sounds a bit circular, but that's the statutory definition. It's built on our common sense notion of what a species is, but it can be challenged fairly quickly. Do y'all know what these species are? Take a guess.
Siberian tiger?
Close. It's a liger. It's a lion-tiger hybrid. Sorry.
A
zonkey, very good. Close, but you're right. It's a breed of a zombie and horse. I'm sorry? Close. Grolar bears, very good. Grizzly polar hybrids. And this is a wolfen. Species is a fluid concept. We are relying on a fairly rudimentary scientific concept to drive the statute. A lot of the Endangered Species Act is now driven by genetic DNA level determinations that you can see species that are visibly indistinguishable, but nonetheless have a separate genetic identity. Other things that look entirely different may be the same species. I can't resist. This is a very quick tale, but this is the pygmy sloth. As you can see, he's basically holding his hand. Right here. It exists right down here in Panama, and it's incredibly rare. At least it was thought to be incredibly rare. I had the an opportunity to talk with a biologist who actually did a survey. He went down there and created the first survey walking through the jungle to identify, and found out that the number was actually much higher than he thought, which we think would be good news. It triggered a firestorm that resulted in him being criminally prosecuted and expelled from the country. Why? Because the government had already used the endangered status of the pygmy sloth to obtain substantial funding and support for creating a national wildlife reserve for it. And that there were strong political consequences of the decision to list, and just as strong political consequences of the decision not to list. I'm just suggesting to you, without getting to the details, there's actually a whole documentary on this, that the same political cross-current applies in the listing decisions here. There are huge political cross-currents every time you have a significant species that's up for listing. Now, what's happened as a result of that cross-current, and I'll just tell a long story short, the listing process broke down in the 1990s, especially during the George W. Bush administration. Listings came to almost a dead halt. Multiple lawsuits followed. Ultimately, again, cutting to the end of the chase, we now have a settlement in place with Defenders of Wildlife, which is going to compel the federal government to list an enormous number of species very quickly. They are all going to be in place, at least 250 of them, by next year. An additional 500 are going to be reviewed up to that point as well. So that's going to have some enormous consequences. We'll talk about it a little bit. Remember I talked about how Section 7 limits what the federal government can do? That means that states that have large amounts of federally held land are heavily impacted by any kind of decision dealing with that land that might involve an endangered species. So as a result, the Endangered Species Act has an enormous impact, particularly in the western portion of the United States. And then there's Texas. Teensy, teensy little Texas. Tiny little portion of our land is actually owned by the federal government. But the endangered species still plays a important role with us. This is a map to be taken with a grain of salt. It's from the Secretary of State from Texas, which has taken the lead in opposing proposals to list species in Texas. This map simply identifies which counties have multiple endangered species, potentially endangered species in. Red is the higher number, purple being the highest. Effectively, Texas has an enormous amount of biodiversity built into it. Once those listing determinations are finalized next year, we're going to find a substantial number of species are suddenly going to have protection that will have economic consequences. For example, you guys know what this is? It's been on the front page several times the past couple of years. The dune sagebrush lizard. A little prettier than the snail darter. He's a those of you who've been out in West Texas, particularly around, say, Del Rio, you'll see these little guys scurrying around everywhere. They are very dependent on a certain type of scrub oak that can only be found along the river valley. And they are also endangered. At least they are proposed for endangered, excuse me. Their populations are severely impacted. There was a great deal of concern that they're about to be listed as endangered. And that result of that, what else is happening in West Texas right now that's causing a big economic impact? Fracking. There is a head-on collision with fracking and the Endangered Species Act with the dune sagebrush lizard. If it had been listed, there was grave concern that this Endangered Species Act determination was going to foreclose the ability to develop oil shales and materials in the West Texas area. So what happened, and this is part of the Section 4 process, there is an off-ramp. There is a way that you can still proceed with a species, with an action, even if it affects the species, by doing what's called a candidate conservation agreement. What is that? Essentially, think about my analogy of the patient who's about to go wheeled to the emergency room, who's dead and dying, whether you can do something more proactively before you get to that point. The candidate conservation agreement is essentially a private agreement between affected stakeholders and the government that these parties will take steps to protect the species in a way so that it will not need to be listed. Essentially, they step up to the plate and agree to do perhaps many of the things that they'd be compelled to do in the Endangered Species Act. But since they do it before the species is listed, they have greater flexibility as to what actions or steps they can take. Does that make sense?
Now, let me say there's an enormous amount of controversy as to whether candidate conservation agreements are legal and effective. A lot of people think that they are essentially a sham. I've had some serious arguments with folks about this. And particularly, there's concerns that the candidate conservation agreement for the dune sagebrush lizard in particular has failed in a spectacular fashion. Other candidate conservation agreements, this is the sage grouse, which essentially lives throughout the central United States. It also has a breeding range that's very broad, so its critical habitat is enormous, and it also theoretically could be affected by oil and gas as well as renewable power development. There's been negotiations over a comprehensive candidate conservation agreement for years to make sure that they're protected. Which then gets us to the big one. What do you do about listing species in designated critical habitat when they're threatened by climate change? What can you do? How many of you have been to Rocky Mountains to hike? Of course you guys have been. When you're hiking up above the tree line, do you ever see these guys? You know what they are? What are they? Close. Yes. Pikas. Also pikas. Just because it sounds like Pikachu.
I'm making little noises.
Yeah, they're little guys. They'll sit in your hand. If you hike up above the tree line and you're hiking past the rocks, they'll stand on top of the rocks, look down at you, and they'll chatter at you. Like, how dare you hike near my rocks? They die if the temperature gets above a certain level. Essentially, they picture them living in the tops of mountains and the ocean of heat is rising around them. As climate change raises surface temperatures, the available surface for them that they can exist on is getting smaller and smaller, and they're retreating higher and higher up the mountains. What do you do? How does the Endangered Species Act apply in a situation where the underlying root cause for a listed species and its critical habitat is premised on global climate change? What can you do? That has probably been, for the past 4 years, the most critical issue in the Endangered Species Act listing process. As you might expect, polar bears are the bellwether. Right now, polar bear populations are increasing. We actually have greater populations than we've had in a long time, particularly in Siberia. The problem is that in the 50-year time range, they're predicting that polar bear is going to be in severe decline. That we actually can forecast that they are going to be threatened at extinction levels within 100 years. So, with that in mind, the United States was presented with multiple petitions as to listing the polar bear. Short answer, right now they have determined the polar bear is threatened but not endangered. That 50-year time window means that it's foreseeable in the future, and the range of critical habitat covers essentially the entire northern coast of Alaska. This is the mother load of the Endangered Species Act litigation. This case has been going on for years and years and years. So bottom line right now is that that determination has been upheld as far as the bear being threatened for climate change effects. The degree of the critical habitat has been successfully challenged, and they're having to go back and re-review it a couple different times now. Last couple of thoughts, species triage. At what point do we start saying this species is beyond saving? There's a lot of folks who are saying we only have so much money, so many resources to protect species. We might save five or four or five with the amount of money we'd spend saving one that's likely a gone, doomed cause. So we're actually seeing rubrics being developed as to which species takes precedence and others that might conceivably just would be trying to protect them, but they're not going to get the same level of protection. And then ultimately, and this is one that's just now starting to become on the horizon, what happens when a species goes extinct, but then you revive it? There's a project called the Lazarus Project, where they're actually working on resurrecting extinct species. And they've had some success. Frogs, insects, there's a concerted effort right now to bring back the passenger pigeon. To what extent does the Endangered Species Act play a role in not only controlling how that's done, but requiring that it be done? To a certain extent, can you do these types of extensive interventions to try and protect a species? Okay, so Once again, I wish we had a three-hour class. Questions so far? All we've really had a chance to talk about is section four. Remember the listings. Remember the danger. Remember threatened. Remember that critical habitat is a flexible, bless you, Kelsey. Flexible concepts of critical habitat if it's threatened, and that candidate conservation agreements can be an off-ramp before you get there. Next class, section seven, federal consultation requirements, what the federal government cannot do if it might affect endangered species. And section nine, what we cannot do as individuals, why we would go to prison if we shoot a whooping crane, which actually happened recently. Patrick?
I was just wondering, for the voluntary review session you got the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, have you given any thought to when that's going to be? Is it going to be during class time?
Yeah, regular class time.
Okay.
Would that work for everybody? I know it's right before Thanksgiving, which kind of sucks, but I thought you'd like to get that out of the way before the holiday.
Would you recommend having the practice exam done?
You'd be better off if you do, because I'll walk through the answer. If you're just doing it on the fly while we go through, you won't get as much value out of it.
Are you recording it?
I know I probably should say no, but yes, I will.
Some of us will be out of town.
I know, but I had this picture of me doing a review to maybe one person or two in the classroom. It's the day before Thanksgiving, I understand. Yeah. All right, then with that, I will not see you till next week, so have a great weekend. And your guest lecturer right now will be Professor Linda Hester from Phillips 66. Do not ask her any questions about me.